Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the show that helps you navigate the just the sheer volume of information out there. We cut through it all to pull out the insights that really matter for you. I'm Pat Livingston, and I'll be your guide today as we unpack the world, according to Bloomberg's reporting, for Friday, August 15th, 2025. Our goal, really, is to connect the dots for you, to sift through all that data and build a clearer picture of what's shaping our world.
And I'm Chris Sinclair. I'm here to add some context, maybe shine a light on the underlying forces at play. We want you to understand not just what's happening, but why it matters. And today's deep dive, Bloomberg for Friday, August 15th, 2025. It's packed. Seriously. We've got global markets, economic shifts, some high stakes, geopolitics, tech breakthroughs, big social challenges. It's quite a mix.
It really is a dense tapestry, as you say, and we're going to try and see how those threads weave together for you.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's dive right in. First up, we're navigating the global economic currents. Inflation, growth patterns, trade policy, it's all in flux.
Yeah, and starting with the U.S. economy, the signals are, well, they're pretty nuanced right now. We've definitely seen some concerning inflationary pressures popping back up.
You mean the PPI data, the producer price index for July?
That's the one. Yeah. It tracks wholesale inflation, what producers are paying. And it jumped.
Jumped how much? Let's get specific.
Okay, so month over month, it was up 0.9%. That's the biggest single monthly jump we've seen since June 2022.
Wow. Okay. That's significant. And annually?
Annually, PPI is up 3.3%. So yeah, inflation at the producer level is definitely heating up again.
So what's behind that surge? Is it raw materials or something else?
It's interesting. The main driver wasn't actually goods this time. It was services. Services inflation climbed 1.1%, which is the most since March 2022.
The services, okay.
But also, and this is important, margins at wholesalers and retailers jumped 2%. So it's not just input costs rising. It's also businesses adding a bit more to their selling price.
Which means it gets passed on to us, the consumers, right? It sounds like companies aren't absorbing these costs anymore.
That's exactly what it looks like. It suggests they're increasingly passing higher costs, maybe linked to import costs from tariffs perhaps, directly onto consumers.
And the market reaction, how did Wall Street take this hotter than expected number?
Well, initially, not great. U.S. stocks, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, they both dipped pretty sharply right after the data came out. They did manage to claw back most of those losses by the close, ending relatively flat. But that initial reaction was telling.
And Treasury yields, they usually react to inflation news.
They sure did. Yields rose, reflecting that renewed concern about prices staying higher for longer.
Which brings us to the Federal Reserve. Everyone's trying to guess their next move, especially now. What are officials saying?
Well, we heard from St. Louis Fed President Alberto Musilm. He was pretty clear, saying it's too early for him to decide on a September rate cut.
Too early? Okay.
And he went further, saying a 50 basis point cut that's 0.5% would be unsupported by the current data. Pretty strong language.
Okay, so Fed official says hold your horses. But the market, what are traders doing?
This is where it gets fascinating. There's a real disconnect. Despite Musilm's caution, market traders are still pricing in something like a 90% chance of a quarter point rate cut in September.
90%. Even after that PPI number and the Fed comments, what's going on there? Are they just ignoring the Fed?
It's, well, it's a bit of a gamble, isn't it? Traders might believe the Fed will eventually cave to market pressure, or maybe they expect other data, like jobs, to soften significantly before the September meeting. Plus, you had Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent publicly suggesting a 50 basis point cut. That kind of comment from the administration adds another layer of complexity, maybe even political pressure.
So the market's basically daring the Fed to hold firm.
You could say that. They're betting the Fed blinks.
And we see the ripple effects immediately in assets like gold, right?
Absolutely. Gold usually likes lower interest rates. So with inflation ticking up and the Fed sounding cautious about cuts, gold actually took a loss for the week. The market is quickly repricing that interest rate outlook.
Okay, let's shift to the labor market. You mentioned jobs data potentially influencing the Fed. What are the latest signals there? Still mixed.
Very mixed. On the one hand, you have initial applications for unemployment benefits. They edged down slightly last week by 3,000 to 224,000.
Which is generally good news, fewer layoffs.
Right. It suggests employers are, you know, generally hesitant to let workers go. That's positive if you have a job.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
There usually is. The but here is continuing claims. That's the number of people already receiving unemployment benefits. And that number remains stubbornly high, around 1.95 million.
Which is near the highest level since 2021, I read.
Exactly. So while fewer people are losing jobs, It seems many who are already unemployed are having a really tough time finding new ones. It points to some underlying weakness, maybe a skills mismatch or employers being very cautious about hiring.
And there was some political drama around the jobs numbers recently, too, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. There was a significant slowdown in job creation over the past 3 months, partly because the figures for May and June were revised downwards quite substantially. Mm. And that led to the very unusual step of the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics being fired.
Wow. That really underscores how sensitive these numbers are, especially politically.
Definitely. It shows just how high the stakes are when it comes to economic data.
Okay, let's broaden our view now to Asia. You mentioned a duality earlier, bright spots alongside conflicts and pressures. Japan seems firmly in the bright spot category right now, market-wise.
Absolutely. Japan's equity markets have been on a tear. Their benchmarks hit record highs 3 times just this past week.
3 times? What's driving that?
Well, the TOPIX index, which is broad measure, rose 1.6% to hit an all-time high. A big driver was financial shares. Banks surged 9.4% just in the week. That's their biggest jump since the market wobble last August.
Banks leading the charge. And tech.
Tech, too. The Nikkei, which is more tech-heavy, climbed 1.7%. A lot of that was SoftBank. Masayoshi Son's company jumped 6.4% on renewed hope about their AI investments.
So is this just market froth, or is there solid economic ground underneath these gains?
It looked pretty solid, actually. The market rally is underpinned by Japan's economy expanding faster than anyone expected. GDP grew at an annualized 1% pace in the April-June quarter.
1% annualized. Wasn't that double the forecast?
It was, yeah. More than double. And that stronger than expected growth has really caught the eye of foreign investors again.
They're coming back in?
Seems like it. They're attracted by the strong performance, especially in large cap stocks, and also by the increasing likelihood that the Bank of Japan might actually raise interest rates soon.
Ah, a rate hike possibility. That would support the yen too, wouldn't it?
Exactly. It creates a sort of positive feedback loop. Hmm. Strong economy, potential rate hike, stronger yen, attracting more foreign investment into equities. It's working well for them right now.
Okay, from Japan's rally, let's head south to Hong Kong. You described it as a dual narrative growth, but also uncertainty. Tell us about the growth part first.
Well, Hong Kong's economy definitely picked up steam in the second quarter. GDP expanded 3.1%, which is the fastest pace they've seen since 2023.
What drove that growth?
Mainly private consumption and exports. And based on that, the government's keeping its full-year economic forecast unchanged.
And the financial sector. That's always key for Hong Kong.
Absolutely critical. The rebound of the financial sector, plus the general expectation of lower global interest rates eventually, is really helping to buoy the overall economic picture.
And there's been a massive influx of money from mainland China, right?
Massive is the word. Mainland Chinese traders bought a record amount of Hong Kong-listed stocks just on Friday, HK $35.9 billion. That's about $4.6 billion U.S. dollars.
A single-day record.
Yep, broke the previous record set back in April. If you look year to date, the money flowing south from the mainland into Hong Kong stocks is now around HK $940 billion. It's huge.
Why the sudden appetite? What are mainland investors seeing in Hong Kong?
It's largely two things. One, Hong Kong stocks look cheaper compared to mainland A shares. Valuations are more attractive. And two, there's a big interest in tech firms listed there, especially companies seen as riding the wave of AI breakthroughs, like those inspired by DeepSeek.
Okay, so cheaper stocks, AI excitement, sounds good. But you mentioned uncertainty earlier. Where does that come in?
The big external headwind is trade policy. Specifically, President Trump's trade policies are widely expected to start weighing on Hong Kong's trade performance later this year.
The tariff impact again?
Exactly. So while the domestic picture looks better and mainland money is flowing in, there's this significant external risk looming over their trade-dependent economy. That's the uncertainty part of the narrative.
Right. Let's turn to mainland China itself now. Another complex picture, signs of slowdown, policy responses, but also some market paradoxes.
Definitely contradictory signals. One really stark sign of slowdown was in lending. For the first time in 20 years, yuan-denominated new loans actually contracted in July.
Contracted, meaning banks lend out less money than was repaid.
Precisely. It points to a really subdued appetite for borrowing and spending, both from businesses and households. And outstanding loans, the total amount lent, also saw their first contraction since 2005. That's a big deal.
How is Beijing responding? Are they rolling out big stimulus plans?
Not really. Not in the traditional sense. Instead of massive stimulus, their recent efforts have focused more on trying to curb what they call cutthroat competition in certain industries, steel, solar, EVs, basically trying to stop damaging price wars.
And the property sector, still a major concern.
Huge concern. Their other main policy move is planning to get central government-owned companies to buy up unsold homes from struggling property developers. It's an attempt to stabilize things, but the scale of the problem is immense.
So economists are worried. I saw warnings about a demand cliff.
Yes. Several economists are flagging the risk of a sharp drop in demand for the rest of the year. They point to factors like Beijing reining in that industrial overcapacity, weaker exports as global demand cools, and the persistent problems in real estate. There's real concern about a potential double dip in the property sector, another major downturn which could drag down the whole economy.
That sounds pretty bleak. But you mentioned a paradox. The stock market isn't reflecting this gloom.
Not entirely, no. China's bond market didn't really react much to the weak loan data. And perhaps more surprisingly, the main onshore equity index, the CSI 300, has actually rallied quite a bit in recent months.
Rallied? Why?
The explanation given is ample liquidity. There's a lot of money sloshing around the system, perhaps due to earlier easing measures. Stock market turnover even hit over $300 billion on Wednesday, the highest since that DeepSeek AI news back in February.
So stocks are up because there's lots of cash, even if the underlying economy is slowing. Doesn't that sound bubbly?
That's the risk, isn't it? It could be speculative capital chasing returns in the market because there aren't enough attractive investment opportunities in the real economy. It highlighted a disconnect between market sentiment, fueled by liquidity, and the fundamental economic picture.
And meanwhile, some of China's biggest companies are just burning cash fighting each other, like the food delivery war.
Exactly. It's incredibly fierce between JD.com, Alibaba, and Meituan. JD.com, for instance, spent heavily on promotions and hiring drivers, and it directly impacted their results.
And investors aren't happy.
They're getting frustrated. Analysts say investors want less food delivery wars and more reasons to be optimistic about AI monetization. These companies are basically fighting tooth and nail over users, often at the expense of short-term profits.
It's a battle for survival, almost.
Fighting for the lifeblood of their business, users, as one analyst put it, yeah.
And it's not just food delivery, right? The EV sector is seeing similar price wars.
Same story there. Geely has been feeling the pain from intense price competition in electric vehicles. BYD, the giant in the space, saw its stock slip 2.6% in Hong Kong recently. It shows these profit-sapping battles are happening across key sectors.
Okay, let's quickly touch on Southeast Asia. Any bright spots there amidst the broader regional complexities?
Yes, a couple of notable ones. In Thailand, the mutual fund industry is booming. Assets hit a record $192 billion in July.
Why the boom?
Partly due to the rally in global stocks boosting returns, but also a rebound in the local Thai market. And the central bank cutting interest rates has also provided some support for the economy and investor sentiment.
In Indonesia.
Indonesian stocks also hit a record high. There's a broad rally happening there, fueled by a combination of a strong domestic economy and, again, hopes for interest rate cuts down the line. So good momentum there.
Okay, let's hop over to Europe now. You described it as a mixed bag earlier. How so?
Well, the overall market, the Stoxx Europe 600 index, actually edged higher, nearing its best level since March. It was up for the third day running.
What was lifting it?
Mostly upbeat earnings reports, particularly from insurance companies like Aviva and Admiral Group. They provided a solid boost.
But there were disappointments tempering that.
Definitely. Aideon, the payments company, saw its stock slide almost 5%. They cited uncertainty about revenue growth stemming directly from the trade war.
There is, again, the trade war impact reaching Europe.
Yep. And HelloFresh, the meal kit company, tumbled 16%. After they lowered their earnings guidance. So while the headline index was up, beneath the surface, individual companies are clearly feeling pressure and uncertainty.
Any other notable European developments? What about energy prices?
Yes.
Yeah.
European natural gas prices actually slid quite a bit, down to near their lowest levels this year.
High the drop.
It's largely anticipation. Specifically, anticipation of that upcoming summit between President Trump and President Putin.
The Alaska summit. People think it might help end the Ukraine war.
That's the hope driving the market move. The thinking is that if the summit leads towards ending the conflict, it could eventually restore gas flows from Russia that were disrupted by the war. Even the possibility of that is enough to push prices down for now.
Interesting how geopolitics directly impacts energy markets like that. Okay, That sets the stage nicely for our next section, where we dig deeper into global policy tariffs, diplomacy, domestic issues.
And President Trump's trade policies are absolutely central to this discussion. Their reach is pervasive.
Let's start with that really unusual deal involving NVIDIA and AMD selling AI chips to China. They have to pay the U.S. government 15% of their revenue.
Yes, it's a very strange arrangement. These companies agreed to basically give the U.S. Treasury 15 cents of every dollar they make selling certain advanced AI chips to China.
Which is a complete reversal, right? Didn't the U.S. try to block these sales entirely before?
A pretty stark reversal, as Bloomberg put it. Mm-hmm. Both the Trump and previous Biden administrations had policies aimed at restricting China's access to these advanced chips on national security grounds. Now it seems the policy is, okay, you can sell them, but we get a cut.
But is that even legal? I thought the U.S. Constitution banned export taxes.
That's the huge question mark hanging over this. The Constitution does indeed prohibit taxes on exports. Trade experts are suggesting there might be legal workarounds, maybe calling it a fee or a condition of a license rather than a tax.
Feels like splitting hairs.
You might be. The chairman of the House Select Committee on China has already publicly questioned the legality. It definitely seems like the administration is pushing the legal envelope here.
So why on earth would NVIDIA and AMD agree to it just to get access to the Chinese market?
That seems to be the calculation. As one source put it, 85% is still better than 0%. They'd rather have 85% of the revenue from China than be completely shut out.
Pragmatism over principle, perhaps.
You can see it that way. It really goes against traditional ideas of free trade and, you know, normal business practices. But it's a clear sign of this administration's very direct, hands-on industrial policy.
Blurring the lines between government and industry.
Absolutely. Think about this alongside the reports of the U.S. government considering taking a stake in Intel. It's a move towards a much more state-directed approach to key industries, especially tech.
And this tariff-driven approach is hitting other countries hard, too. Switzerland, for example.
Yeah.
A 39% U.S. tariff.
Yes. Switzerland got hit with one of the steepest tariffs among developed nations, 39%. Their economy actually grew unexpectedly in Q2, but analysts think that was mainly because exporters rushed shipments out before the tariffs fully hit. They're worried about the future.
Especially for their pharmaceutical sector, right? That's huge for Switzerland.
Crucial. Giants like Roche and Novartis are talking to the Swiss government because that 39% tariff, combined with the pressure the U.S. is already putting on drug prices, could genuinely cause a significant slowdown in Swiss GDP growth. Some even mention a risk of recession.
Wow, that's a massive potential impact.
It is, and you're already seeing companies adapt on the ground. Lindt, the chocolatier.
The Easter bunnies.
Those exact ones, the gold wrap bunnies. They're currently made in Germany. Lindt is considering moving production to the U.S. to get around a 15% tariff on EU goods.
Making chocolate bunnies in America to avoid tariffs.
And they're also thinking about moving production for the Canadian market out of the U.S. from Boston to Europe because of retaliatory tariffs from Canada. It's a global supply chain shuffle, all driven by these tariffs.
Okay, how about Australia? They lifted their ban on U.S. beef. Is that a major concession?
It's being seen as a move to appease Donald Trump, yes. But in practical terms, it's probably a relatively small matter for Australia right now.
Why small?
Because the U.S. cattle herd is at a 70-year low due to drought and other factors. They just don't have a lot of excess beef to export right now. Imports into Australia were tiny the first half of the year, like 400 tons.
Hmm.
So U.S. beef isn't going to flood Australian shelves anytime soon.
So it's more symbolic, a political calculation.
Exactly. It looks like a strategic move to offer a concession in an area that doesn't hurt much, hoping to take the heat off other Australian industries like steel or pharmaceuticals that Trump has also targeted. Smart diplomacy, perhaps?
Meanwhile, India is heading in the opposite direction, with Prime Minister Modi talking about economic selfishness.
Yes, in a major Independence Day speech, Modi really pushed for self-reliance in key sectors, energy, minerals, defense. He urged companies to focus on high-quality domestic production.
And policy actions followed.
He announced cuts to consumption taxes, the first in nearly a decade, aiming to boost domestic demand. And he very pointedly pledged to stand like a wall against any harmful policies affecting India's farmers and fishermen.
Which relates to trade talks with the U.S., doesn't it?
Directly. The U.S.-India trade deal has been stalled for ages, largely because India refuses to open its market further to U.S. agricultural and dairy products. Modi's speech reinforces that protectionist stance, India first.
Okay, back to the U.S. You mentioned cardboard boxes as an unusual economic indicator earlier.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Sales of corrugated cardboard boxes, the boxes used for shipping everything, are down. International Paper reported a 5% drop in daily shipments. Smurfit Westrock saw a 4.5% slide in North America.
So fewer boxes being sold means fewer goods being shipped.
That's the interpretation. It's seen as a non-traditional sign that retail demand might be cooling off, or at least the companies are hesitant to stock up on packaging because they're uncertain about future costs, possibly due to tariffs.
And this has real-world consequences.
Absolutely. International Paper, for example, had to close a mill in Louisiana because of falling demand. That means lost jobs, lost tax revenue for the local community. It shows how these big macroeconomic trends and trade policies trickle down and impact people directly.
Okay, shifting from trade to pure geopolitics now, the Trump-Putin summit in Alaska. Why Alaska?
Well, the venue itself is generating buzz. The Kremlin apparently suggested it, and some analysts see it as a sly strategy, maybe playing on Alaska's history with Russia, appealing to Trump's real estate background, trying to frame it as neutral ground, perhaps.
Interesting angle, but expectations seem low, right? Both sides are downplaying it.
Very divergent public statements. Putin has been praising Trump's efforts to end the Ukraine war. Trump, on the other hand, gave it only a 25% chance of success, saying his main goal is just to set the table for the next meeting.
So Trump wants to frame it as a win just by having it on U.S. soil, maybe paving the way for involving Ukraine's President Zelensky later.
That seems to be his framing, yes. Holding it on U.S. soil is presented as a victory in itself.
And Putin's goal, what does Russia want out of this?
Analysts believe Putin primarily wants to separate the war in Ukraine from other aspects of the U.S.-Russia relationship, especially economic ones. Getting relief from energy and financial sanctions is likely top of his list, given how reliant Russia is now on selling discounted oil to China and India.
But Trump said no concessions like access to minerals or pulling back NATO forces.
He dismissed those ideas publicly. Yes. It suggests there are still major obstacles to any kind of grand bargain. Putin wants sanctions relief, but Trump isn't signaling willingness to give much ground, at least not on those specific points.
We already talked about European gas prices falling in anticipation of this summit.
Right. The mere hope that the summit might lead to an end to the conflict that disrupted Russian fuel flows was enough to push prices down.
But actual sanctions relief depends on more than just a meeting, presumably.
Oh, absolutely. The consensus view seems to be that any significant easing of energy sanctions would require a verifiable end to the war in Ukraine and credible commitments to reconstruction. A summit is just talk. Real change requires concrete actions on the ground.
Okay, let's pivot to domestic pressures now. Starting in the UK, the Labour government seems to be facing some tough fiscal challenges.
They really are. Chancellor Rachel Reeves is in a tight spot. She's had to do some costly policy U-turns recently, like bringing back winter fuel payments they'd planned to cut and backing down on disability benefit changes. All this while government borrowing costs remain high. It's a repair job, as they say.
So how do they fill the gap? Are tax hikes inevitable?
That seems to be the prevailing view among economists. The alternatives aren't great. Easing their own fiscal rules could spook the markets, risking a repeat of the Liz Truss mini-budget chaos from 2022.
Right, nobody wants that again.
And cutting popular public spending is always politically difficult. So yeah, tax rises look like the most probable path, even if it's unpopular.
Any specific ideas being floated besides just raising income tax or VAT?
One idea getting attention is a tourist tax for London. London is actually quite unusual among major global cities for not having one. It's seen as a potential revenue stream, maybe even a growth driver if handled right, perhaps letting local councils decide whether to implement it.
And maybe museum fees for non-residents.
That's another suggestion, yeah, like the Met in New York does. But while they're looking for revenue, there's a worrying trend happening on the ground.
What's that?
London is really taking the hit from the UK's overall jobs slowdown. The capital has lost nearly 45,000 payroll jobs since last October.
Why London specifically?
It seems linked to recent tax hikes, like the increase in employers' national insurance contributions, and also the impact of a new, higher national minimum wage. Sectors like retail and hospitality, which are big in London, have been hit particularly hard, so fiscal pressures are having very real employment consequences.
Okay, let's cross the Atlantic to Bolivia. An economic crisis, a crucial election coming up, and a gold rush helping them stay afloat.
It's a wild situation. Bolivia is facing a severe dollar shortage. Their local currency is in crisis. Inflation is soaring. Their natural gas income is drying up. And fuel subsidies are draining the treasury.
It's dire.
Protests and shortages.
Yes. Sporadic protests are happening, and there are shortages of basic goods. But, remarkably, the central bank has managed to buy over $3 billion worth of gold, mostly from small-scale, often informal miners, and then swap that gold internationally for the dollars they desperately need to pay foreign bondholders.
So the gold rush is literally keeping the country solvent for now.
It seems to be a crucial, if chaotic, lifeline.
And the election on August 17th, what's the market hoping for?
Well, Bolivian dollar bonds have actually rallied over 30% this year. That's based on optimism that a more market-friendly government might win the election and implement reforms.
But there's a risk of a leftist candidate winning.
Yes. Jorge Tudor Quiroga Rodriguez is the main leftist candidate. If he wins unexpectedly, investors worry he might pursue policies less favorable to bondholders, potentially leading to defaults.
And former President Evo Morales still looms large.
He does. Even though he's barred from running, he has a significant base of support, especially among indigenous groups and coca growers. There's a real concern he could call for disruptive protests if the right-leaning candidate wins, which could destabilize the country further.
And the gold mining itself, is it all above board?
That's another major issue. There's a serious lack of transparency. Reports mention lax regulation, widespread use of toxic mercury, flimsy paperwork, even involvement of illegal foreign financiers. The government claims it's legal, but the reality on the ground seems much messier.
Okay, shifting to Indonesia, President Prabowo is cracking down on illegal mining there too.
Yes, he stated his intention to rectify the illegal mining situation, which is estimated to have cost the Indonesian state something like $19 billion in lost revenue.
Is this part of a broader push?
It seems to be. Since taking office, Prabowo has been quite aggressive in targeting the huge commodity sector. There's a legal case against Wilmar over palm oil violations, investigations into the state oil company Pertamina, probes into environmental issues at nickel smelters.
He's not holding back.
No. And the timing is interesting. This crackdown comes as Indonesia's economy is actually doing quite well. Fastest growth in 2 years, stock market at record highs.
Wow.
That gives him the political space and economic cushion to push through these tougher reforms in the often murky resources sector.
Right. Let's look at Serbia now. Violent anti-government protests. What triggered those?
It's the biggest challenge President Vučić has faced in over a decade. The initial spark was a horrific incident. 16 people were crushed to death when a concrete canopy collapsed at a train station in Novi Sad.
Oh, terrible.
Just awful. And that tragedy seemed to unleash broader public anger and frustration, snowballing into larger protests demanding accountability and Vučić's resignation.
How has the government responded?
Forcefully. Police have used tear gas against protesters. Vučić himself has vowed to put down the protests, saying the state will prevail. Hundreds have reportedly been injured or arrested. It signals a period of significant unrest and instability there.
Back in the U.S., we're seeing cancellations of cultural festivals due to immigration concerns.
Yeah, it's a noticeable trend. Anxiety over the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, including increased ICE raids, is leading organizers to cancel events out of an abundance of caution.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. Pittsburgh canceled its first ever local World Cup event and its annual international parade. Cinco de Mayo parades were called off in places like Chicago and Philadelphia. Even some July 4th celebrations in Los Angeles were affected.
Why cancel? Fear of raids targeting attendees.
That's the core fear, yes.
Yeah.
Immigrant communities worry that large public gatherings could become targets for ICE enforcement. And there have also been reports and accusations of racial profiling, where U.S. citizens have allegedly been swept up in raids too. It's creating a chilling effect on community life and cultural expression.
We're also seeing corporations making decisions under social pressure. Costco deciding not to sell the abortion pill Mifepristone.
That's right. Costco pharmacies won't be stocking Mifepristone, reportedly after pressure from a coalition of faith-based activist groups.
This is part of the bigger battle over abortion access post-Roe v. Wade, isn't it?
Exactly. With abortion laws now varying wildly state by state, access to Mifepristone has become a major flashpoint. These religious groups have had success pressuring other big retailers like Kroger, Walmart, and Albertsons as well.
But not everyone agrees with Costco's decision.
No. New York City's comptroller, Brad Lander, called it disappointing and short-sighted, arguing it risks isolating customers. Meanwhile, CVS is continuing to dispense the drug in states where it's legal. It just highlights how companies are caught in the middle of these deeply divisive social issues.
There's also ongoing debate about who gets to invest in private markets, the accredited investor rule.
Yeah, the rule that basically restricts investments in things like private equity or hedge funds to people with a certain level of income or net worth.
What's the argument for keeping that rule?
The main argument is investor protection. Private investments are often complex, opaque, lack transparency. Proponents say the rule acknowledges that it can be impossible to make a well-informed choice without that transparency, especially now when there might be headwinds coming for private equity and credit.
But there are calls for reform, maybe letting more people in.
Yes, ideas like replacing the wealth test with a financial literacy test are floated. But there are also concerns, especially about proposals to allow these less liquid, riskier private assets into mainstream retirement accounts like 401ks. It's a balance between access and protection.
Finally, on the domestic front, a really worrying cybersecurity breach affecting U.S. courts. Russian hackers.
Extremely worrying. It turns out Russian government hackers have apparently been inside the electronic record system of U.S. federal courts for years.
Years. What did they get?
They reportedly stole sealed files from highly sensitive cases, things like espionage investigations, major fraud cases, money laundering probes.
The implications are huge, right? Compromise investigations, people exposed.
That's the major concern. Identifying confidential informants, compromising ongoing investigations, it's serious. And the root cause seems to be that the judiciary's computer systems are outdated and vulnerable, apparently due to years of underfunding from Congress.
Have they done anything to fix it?
They hired a cybersecurity firm, Unit 42, to investigate and help clean up. And they recently implemented multi-factor authentication, which is a basic security step. But it reveals a critical vulnerability at the heart of the justice system.
Okay, let's shift gears now to innovation. AI, healthcare, connectivity, lots happening here. The AI ecosystem is just white hot, isn't it? Investment, valuations.
Absolutely on fire. Look at Masayoshi Son at SoftBank. His personal wealth jumped $11 billion just in August because SoftBank's shares hit record highs, all driven by optimism about their AI investments.
And AI startups are raising huge amounts.
Constantly. Lambda Inc., an AI cloud firm backed by NVIDIA, is apparently talking about a $4 or $5 billion valuation ahead of a possible IPO. Cohere, another AI startup, just raised $500 million at a $6.8 billion valuation. There's even a Swedish AI startup called Lovable, aiming for $1 billion in annualized sales next year, calling itself the fastest growing startup in the world. The money and ambition are just staggering.
But this rapid growth creates challenges too, right? You mentioned the superintelligence talent challenge.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Meta, for example, is pouring resources into building a superintelligence dream team. They're actively poaching top AI researchers from rivals like OpenAI, Anthropic, Google DeepMind. Mark Zuckerberg defends it as necessary to compete.
But managing a team full of geniuses, can that backfire?
History and research suggest it can. It's being called the management challenge of the century. Studies going back decades show that just throwing lots of brilliant people together doesn't always work. You can get diminishing returns because of ego clashes, poor teamwork, people hoarding information.
So how do you manage a star team effectively?
The thinking is you need really clear structures, define roles very clearly, give everyone their swimming lane, and be explicit about who has decision-making power on what. It's about providing clarity and managing those competitive dynamics in a super high-stakes environment.
Interesting. And even former execs are jumping into the AI fray.
Yep. Parag Agrawal, the former CEO of Twitter, has launched his own AI company called Parallel. He's obviously leveraging his network and experience. It just shows AI is the place to be for top tech talent right now.
But AI needs a massive amount of power, and that's creating bottlenecks, like a shortage of transformers.
A huge bottleneck. The U.S. is facing a growing shortage of transformers, those big boxes you see on the power poles that step down voltage. Demand from AI data centers and other electrification trends is expected to outstrip supply by maybe 30% this year.
And that shortage continues for years.
Projections say it could persist well into the 2030s. This drives up costs for power projects, lengthens timelines, and puts serious strain on an already aging electrical grid.
So much strain that the grid watchdog is suggesting data centers build their own power plants.
Monitoring Analytics LLC did recommend that large data centers be required to bring their own generation. That's a pretty radical suggestion, showing the scale of the problem.
And climate change makes this worse. Heat waves impact power.
Definitely. Extreme heat reduces the efficiency of power plants, affects wind turbines, and increases demand for cooling. Data centers themselves use about a third of their energy just for cooling. Remember the London heat wave in 2022? Some hospital servers actually shut down because the data centers they relied on overheated. It shows the vulnerability.
Okay, let's look at AI in consumer tech. Peloton is integrating AI.
Big time. They're planning major product upgrades, new bike, new treadmill, accessories. But the core seems to be an integrated AI platform. They're talking about things like an AI running coach, using data from your other fitness apps to suggest workouts, making the experience much more personalized and data-driven.
Meanwhile, Apple got its blood oxygen feature back on the Apple Watch.
Yes, they did, in the U.S. After that long patent dispute with Masimo, they apparently found a software workaround that U.S. Customs approved, so the feature is being restored. Wearable tech innovation continues, along with the legal battles.
And NVIDIA. Despite that controversial 15% tax on sales to China, investors still love them.
Enthusiasm seems undimmed. One of their key partners, Han Hai, you probably know them as Foxconn, expects its sales of AI servers to more than double. It suggests the underlying demand for AI computing power is just incredibly strong, overriding geopolitical concerns for now.
Shifting to healthcare innovation, a big jump for Valneva stock. Because of a chikungunya vaccine.
Yes, Valneva shares surged 23%. Their chikungunya vaccine is the first one ever approved globally, and there's strong demand because of recent outbreaks in places like southern China and the Indian Ocean region. It's a major public health tool.
And they have a Lyme disease vaccine in the works, too.
They do. In partnership with Pfizer, it's in late-stage trials, and results are expected by the end of the year. If it's successful, that would be huge, as there's currently no human vaccine for Lyme disease. A really significant potential breakthrough.
Okay, and global connectivity Starlink expanding into airlines. A deal with Saudi.
Looks like it's close. Elon Musk's Starlink is reportedly nearing a deal to put its satellite internet service on Saudi's entire fleet, which is over 140 aircraft.
That's a big win for Starlink in the in-flight internet market, isn't it?
A significant milestone, yes. It's a very competitive space. This gives SpaceX, Starlink's parent company, a major foothold in the Gulf's biggest economy.
How does the business model work for airlines?
They pay an upfront hardware cost, apparently between $300,000 and $500,000 per plane, plus an ongoing monthly fee based on the number of seats. It's a big investment for the airline, but high-speed internet is becoming a must-have for passengers.
Right. Now let's touch on fintech and crypto. There's a battle brewing over bank data, fintechs versus big banks.
A major battle. Top executives from fintech firms like Klarna and Robinhood, plus crypto exchanges like Gemini and Kraken, are pushing the Trump administration not to let big U.S. banks charge fees for accessing customer data.
Why are banks proposing fees?
Banks like JP Morgan and PNC argue that these fintechs and data aggregators are essentially freeloaders, using customer data accessed via APIs without paying for the infrastructure or security costs involved.
And the fintechs' argument?
They say these fees would cripple innovation, force smaller players out of business, and basically slam the door on a more open and modern financial system. It's a fundamental fight over who controls and profits from customer financial data in the digital age.
We also saw a very strange crypto deal involving the Trump and Witkoff families.
Yeah, highly unusual is how Bloomberg described it. A company called ALT5 Sigma is basically becoming a holding company for WLFI tokens, which are linked to a project called World Liberty. They'll own 7.5% of the total token supply.
But these WLFI tokens aren't even traded anywhere.
Exactly. That's what makes it so odd. Creating a public company structure, essentially to hold a speculative, untradable, illiquid digital token, it really blurs the lines between public securities and the wild west of crypto assets. It kind of echoes Michael Saylor's strategy at MicroStrategy, buying Bitcoin for the corporate treasury, but this takes it a step further by involving a completely non-marketable token.
Interesting. On a brighter fintech note, dLocal, the payments firm from Uruguay, saw a huge stock surge.
Huge. Up 35% after reporting better-than-expected results and raising their future guidance.
They had a rough patch, though, didn't they? Fraud accusation.
They really did. After a splashy IPO in 2021, their value cratered in the global fintech sell-off. Then came fraud allegations from short seller Muddy Waters and a regulatory probe in Argentina. It was looking bad.
So what turned it around?
It seems largely due to a management overhaul. They brought in a new CEO from Mercado Libre, a new CFO. Strong leadership seems to have steadied the ship and rebuilt investor confidence. It's quite a comeback story.
And finally, in this space, successful IPOs for exchange operators,
right.
MEIX and Bullish.
Yes, strong debuts for both. MEIX, a more traditional exchange operator, jumped 39% after its IPO, And Bullish, a crypto exchange, surged an incredible 84% on its first day of trading.
What does that tell us? Still appetite for trading platforms.
It definitely suggests continued investor confidence in the infrastructure of trading, both traditional and crypto. The Bullish IPO, especially, indicates there's still significant interest and perceived value in regulated platforms for trading digital assets, despite market volatility.
Okay, let's move into our final major section, the broader global challenges, climate, conflict, quality of life issues. Starting with the environment, the failure of the global plastic treaty talks is a big setback.
A really significant failure, unfortunately. The goal was a legally binding treaty to curb plastic pollution, but the talks in Geneva collapsed without an agreement.
Why did they fail?
Deep divisions between the 170 countries involved, hardline positions on key issues, and ultimately, delegates couldn't agree on a text that many felt wasn't strong enough or sufficiently binding anyway.
So what happens now with global efforts on plastics?
They're thrown into doubt, essentially. Without a global framework, progress relies on voluntary actions and individual country efforts, which historically hasn't been enough to tackle the scale of the plastic pollution problem. It's a major blow.
And meanwhile, the immediate impacts of climate change are visible with wildfires in Europe.
Absolutely. Deadly fires continue to burn in Greece and Spain, and they've also affected Cyprus. This follows four major heat waves across Europe just this summer.
The impact is devastating, I assume. Evacuations?
Thousands evacuated, infrastructure like power poles destroyed, massive disruption. The EU has had to send firefighting planes and helicopters to help. And the connection to climate change is undeniable. Scientists are clear. Climate change is making these heat waves in Europe more frequent and intense, which in turn fuels more extreme fire conditions.
In Zambia, there's controversy over a mine pollution spill. The government says water is safe, but an audit disagrees.
That's the situation. A spill happened back in February at a Chinese state-owned copper mine. The government assured the public the water was safe, but then an independent environmental audit came out with starkly different findings. It suggested 30 times more toxic sludge was released than the government admitted and warned of persisting serious health risks and a potential large-scale environmental catastrophe.
That's a massive discrepancy. Raises serious questions about transparency.
Huge questions. About the government's monitoring, the company's practices, and the actual risk to the local population. It's a worrying situation.
Looking ahead, the U.S. is now under a La Nina watch for hurricane season. What does that mean?
It means there's a 53% chance that La Nina conditions, which involve cooler than average sea surface temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific, will develop during the peak hurricane months, September to November.
And La Nina typically means more hurricanes in the Atlantic.
Generally, yes. La Nina tends to reduce wind shear over the Atlantic basin. Wind shear, those abrupt changes in wind speed and direction at different altitudes, tends to rip developing storms apart. Less shear means conditions are more favorable for storms to form and strengthen. So unfortunately, it points to an increased risk this season.
Finally, on the environmental health front, the poultry industry is still struggling with bird flu, H5N1.
It's an ongoing global crisis. Over 500 million farmed birds have been culled worldwide to try and contain the virus. That's a staggering number.
And this highlights issues with intensive farming.
It really does. Think about it. Even free-range birds in the UK were kept indoors for long periods because of the virus risk. And some regulations allow birds labeled free-range to be confined for up to half their short lives anyway. When you have birds packed so closely together, disease can spread like wildfire. It raises ethical questions about the nasty, brutish, and short lives of these birds, but also highlights the fragility of a system focused purely on maximizing output.
Okay, let's turn to issues of justice, rights, and social change. The trial of Jimmy Lai in Hong Kong is being closely watched.
Very closely. He's the former media mogul facing national security charges that could result in an effective life sentence. His trial was adjourned briefly for medical reasons, but is resuming.
Why is it seen as such a litmus test?
Because since Beijing imposed the national security law in 2020, political opposition and dissent in Hong Kong have been effectively silenced. This trial is seen globally as a key indicator of whether the rule of law and basic civil liberties still have meaning there.
And the U.S. is involved.
President Trump mentioned he specifically raised Jimmy Lai's case with China. That direct intervention signals the high level of international scrutiny and pressure surrounding the trial.
A different kind of rights issue gaining traction is the Rights for Nature movement, giving legal rights to rivers and forests.
It's a fascinating legal and philosophical concept that's gaining real ground. The idea is to grant legal personhood to natural entities, allowing lawsuits to be brought on their behalf to protect them. It draws parallels to how rights were extended to previously disenfranchised human groups.
Are there actual examples of this working?
Yes, several. New Zealand's Whanganui River was famously the first, back in 2017. Since then, rivers in Colombia, Canada, Bangladesh have gained similar status. Some UK councils are acknowledging river rights. Paris is looking at it for the Seine.
But does giving a river legal rights actually stop pollution?
That's the crucial caveat. Granting rights doesn't automatically solve the underlying problems. Spain's Mar Menor Lagoon, for instance, has legal personhood, but is still struggling badly with pollution from agricultural runoff. Legal rights are a tool, potentially a powerful one, but enforcement and tackling the root causes are still essential.
In the UK, we're seeing more elderly activists at protests.
It's become a striking sight, yes. Older people, pensioners, cuddly grannies, as one report put it, are increasingly visible at demonstrations for groups like Just Stop Oil or Palestine Action.
Why the trend? Are they being used by these groups, or is it genuine conviction?
Probably a mix of motivations. Some critics suggest they might be useful idiots, providing a softer image for groups whose tactics might alienate the public. Mm-hmm. But many are undoubtedly driven by genuine idealism, maybe even a sense of guilt about the fate of the world being left to younger generations.
Is it part of a bigger shift in protest culture?
It seems to reflect a broader trend in Britain since around 2000, where direct action and street protests have become more common across various issues and demographics, sometimes bypassing traditional political channels. Tactics that were once marginal are now more mainstream.
Okay, let's look at the new FBI crime statistics in the U.S. The overall trend is down, right?
Yes. Crime reportedly fell in 2024 and continued declining into 2025, which is positive news.
But the nature of crime revealed by the new data system is interesting, not random attacks.
That's perhaps the biggest takeaway from the more detailed NIBRS data. Violent crime is overwhelmingly not random strangers attacking people on the street. It's mostly familiar people in familiar places doing terrible things to one another.
Where does most crime happen?
The number one location for both violent crime, 28%, and property crime, 33%, is in a resident's home. And the most common circumstances leading to murders and aggravated assaults are arguments and domestic violence. Guns remain the primary weapon in homicides.
The data also touches on demographic disparities, which is always sensitive. What does it show factually?
Factually reporting the data. Black Americans are statistically overrepresented among known offenders for most crimes, except extortion. They're even more significantly overrepresented among homicide victims, making up 48.8% of victims, compared to 47.2% of known offenders.
Why the disparity in victimization?
The analysis often points to factors like higher concentration in high crime, high gun violence neighborhoods, and the systemic impacts of poverty. The data also shows men are vastly overrepresented as both offenders, 86% of homicide offenders, and victims, 77% of homicide victims. So the detailed data suggests homicides are often tragic. Non-random events involving people who know each other, frequently involving arguments, domestic situations, and guns, with young men, particularly young black men, disproportionately involved as both victims and perpetrators.
Okay, moving to our final theme. Urban living and lifestyle trends. Manhattan rents are just going through the roof.
Unprecedented levels. Median rent hit a record $4,700 a month in July. That's the fifth record high in just 6 months. Up $75 from June and over 9% higher than a year ago.
And bidding wars are common.
More common than ever. Nearly 30% of leases signed in July involved a bidding war, an all-time high. It was one of the most competitive months ever for renters.
Is it just Manhattan?
No, the pressure is spreading. Brooklyn's median rent hit $3,850, its second highest ever. Northwest Queens is up almost 9% year over year to $3,750. It's an affordability crisis across the board in New York City.
But the city is trying to address it with rezoning, converting offices to housing.
Yes, the city council just approved a major rezoning in Midtown South. It covers 42 lots and could allow for over 9,500 new apartments, with about a third designated as permanently affordable.
How significant is this?
It's a big test. The idea is to convert some of those vacant or underused office buildings into badly needed housing. It's seen as a key part of Mayor Adams' City of Yes initiative to encourage development. If it works, other cities might follow suit.
In Europe, co-housing is becoming more popular, people sharing living spaces.
Yeah, particularly in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. It's driven partly by the housing crunch, but also by a desire for more community and less loneliness. People share meals, chores, social activities.
Does it work? Does it solve the housing shortage?
It definitely helps individuals cut costs and build connections. But analysts point out the scale probably isn't big enough to solve the overall housing shortage. And adapting to communal living isn't easy for everyone. Turnover rates can be high. It meets a need for community, but has practical challenges.
London has a twist on community living with the public house group. Pubs as quasi-members clubs.
It's a clever model. They run pubs that aim to foster a strong sense of community, like a members club, but without the formal membership or fees. They seem to have found a successful business structure too, backed by a large family office, allowing them to weather the pressures in the hospitality sector.
And on the high-tech wellness front, the Immortal Chamber. Robot massages.
Huh, yes. It's described as the latest in wellness treatments needing minimal human interaction. Light therapy, sound therapy, robotic massage. Tapping into that huge global wellness tourism market, which is projected to hit $9 trillion by 2028.
But does it replace human touch?
The article suggests maybe not entirely. While these high-tech treatments offer subtle results, many people still feel that therapies involving actual human therapists provide a deeper sense of rest and restoration. An interesting contrast between tech efficiency and the human element in wellness.
Finally, a bright spot for luxury goods. Used watches are doing well.
Relatively speaking, yes. The market for pre-owned luxury watches, your Rolexes, Pateks, etc., had its best first half performance since early 2022. In a generally tough market for high-end goods, used watches seem to be holding their value better, offering a bright spot.
Okay, that brings us to the end of our journey through today's Bloomberg report. We've covered a huge amount of ground economic shifts, geopolitical tensions, tech leaps, social issues.
And hopefully you can see how interconnected it all is. Inflation affects Fed policy, which affects markets globally. Trade policy impacts specific industries in Switzerland and consumer prices in the U.S. AI development creates power, demands that strain grids potentially affected by climate change.
It really underscores the need to look beyond individual headlines, doesn't it? To see the underlying patterns and potential ripple effects.
Absolutely. Critical thinking, connecting those dots, it's crucial in making sense of such a complex world.
So, to leave you with something to think about. Considering everything we've touched on today, from tariffs reshaping supply chains to AI's exponential growth, the intricacies of crime data, or even the resilience of the used watch market, what seemingly small detail or overlooked connection from today's deep dive do you think might have the most unexpected or profound impact in the coming months? And how can we as informed citizens better anticipate and prepare for the often unseen ripple effects that emerge from all these complex global interconnections? That's all for this edition of The Deep Dive. Thanks for joining us. We hope this helps you feel more informed and connected. We'll be back soon to unpack another set of crucial developments.